Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Glad to have you aboard for this edition of the program. As we do from time to time here on the pod, we're bringing you a discussion about the week with Becky Gray and Rob Schofield. Becky works with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Rob is with the progressive NC Policy Watch. This is also a radio segment that you can hear each Friday afternoon at 4:50 on WUNC, or, of course, find it on demand at WUNC.org. It's a weekly conversation we've been having for a year now. The goal when we started was to have two people who generally don't see eye to eye in a room together for what is hopefully a civil discourse. At times, as you'll hear in this latest chat, it can get heated. But dialogue and debate remain an imperative part of our democracy. I am appreciative that people continue to listen to these discussions, and my hope is that you'll engage with people who view things differently than you. Anyway, here are Becky and Rob.
Hey.
Hi, Jeff.
The election season here is underway with candidate filings, yet unsurprisingly, there was another lawsuit filed this week over political maps. Groups that have previously sued over gerrymandering of legislative districts returned to state court Wednesday. They say four state house seats in Wake County should not have been redrawn by lawmakers last summer. Federal judges did not order those four districts to be redrawn. Now, the plaintiffs say this round of redistricting violates the state constitution, which prohibits mid-decade redistricting. Rob, if GOP lawmakers overstepped by redrawing those seats last August, then why is this being challenged now, 6 months later? Shouldn't the legal challenge have come a while back?
Well, I think they thought that the federal courts might take care of it. There were, you know, there was an omnibus complaint against the illegal gerrymandering that had been going on, and I think the expectation and hope was that the federal court, and indeed I think in some of the earlier rulings the federal courts were purporting to take care of it. So once that was once they learned that that was no longer going to be the case, their route was to go to state court. Really, the plaintiffs in this case, Southern Coalition for Social Justice, other pro-democracy groups, they're kind of like bulldogs on this. They've got a scent, I think, and they realize that this gerrymandering thing is on its way out, and they are going to pursue it every possible avenue they can. They know the public's with them. They know that the Constitution is with them, and I wish them good luck.
Jeff, I think, you know, a couple points here. One, I mean, what we have heard Democrats actually say is, we intend to sue till it's blue. And this is just another example, as David Lewis said earlier this week.
Have
this
we heard
lawsuit,
Democrats say that, or is that the rhetoric we've heard from Republicans about the Democratic suits?
I think I've heard Republicans say, this is what Democrats have said, we intend to sue until we're blue,
but it is yet another
lawsuit in this unending saga of lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. This really is just political. This is a blatant political move to try to redistrict, try to get a Democrat advantage in Wake County with those four Wake County districts. I think it's kind of ironic that, you know, one of the claims that this lawsuit has is that you can't change the districts in the middle of a decade. But yet we've had, what, a half a dozen lawsuits that want to change the districts in the middle of the decade. And here we are in the, you know, we are going into the last week of filing for this 2018 election. It seems to me that the time for these lawsuits would have been weeks or months ago, but not right now where we are in the middle of filing, as if to insert even more confusion into this.
The distinction, though, tell me if you see it differently, is that some of the other redistricting that has happened since the 2011 natural redistricting cycle has been court-ordered. And what happened last August, according to these plaintiffs, was not court-ordered, and they went ahead and redrew it anyway.
Well, and you know, along those lines, you know, these court cases are working their way through the courts, through state courts, through federal court, through the U.S. Supreme Court. We need to let those work their way through rather than continue to throw these cogs in the wheel of the process that's trying to work out.
Well, I don't think there were any other cases that would have affected this. That's the very reason that they brought the lawsuit. The federal courts have said, we're not going to deal with this state issue. You got a state constitutional right here vindicated in state court. So this is a nonpartisan group that has had plenty of problem with Democrats down through the years. They're just trying to get fair maps.
Concisely, is this a Hail Mary? Is this something else? I mean, how would you classify this specific challenge?
I just think it's obviously not a massive lawsuit. It's not affecting a large number of districts, but it is just one more bite at the apple that these good government groups are taking. They realize gerrymandering's on the way out, and they're going to do everything they can to keep pushing.
I think it's, as Rob said, it's one more bite at the apple and, another blatant political move.
A week after the massacre in Parkland, Florida, our nation continues to discuss firearms, school safety, and what policy changes may be feasible. North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore announced a committee that will be seated, announced it earlier this week, to study school safety. Now, attempting to set the rhetoric and talking points aside for a moment, I'd love to hear a specific idea or two from each of you about an improved safety measure that our state needs right now. Becky.
Jeff, to be honest with you, I think it's premature to make those kind of recommendations. I think this is the very reason why Speaker Tim Moore has set up this committee to look at this, to study this. Now, some of the things that we're hearing nationally, from other groups, some of the things that I know are going to be on the table are perhaps increasing the public safety officers that are in the schools, to do that. There's also talk about revisiting certain bans on different kinds of guns and all of those. And what I've heard Speaker Moore say as he rolled this committee out this week, everything is on the table. Everything's going to be discussed. Everything's going to be considered. I don't think this is one where, one or two suggestions is going to get us where we need to be. This is a complex problem. And I think that cool heads, analytical heads, and getting lots and lots of information together is the way to go with that.
But to be fair, they make nips and tucks and adjustments all the time in that building. Are there any nips or tucks or adjustments that you think are just obvious and need to take place?
Well, I don't think that's up to me to say, to be honest with you. I think that's the work of this committee and experts and other people across the country. Jeff, I was horrified by this situation, as so many people are, and I don't feel like it's my place to say, well, here's the answer or here are the suggestions. I know there are lots of things that people are considering, and it's a serious problem, and I look forward to watching it, to monitoring it. But at this point, I just feel like it's premature, and it's certainly not my place to make those kind of recommendations.
I think it's all of our places to make recommendations. This feels very much to me like the folks who forever said, well, that evidence on smoking's not conclusive yet, or that evidence on climate change isn't conclusive. We know what the heck the problem is here. We are selling mass military-grade mass killing machines to children and allowing them to own them. And then we're selling them to mentally disturbed people without background checks. These are mass weapons effectively of mass destruction. It is absurd. It needs to stop. I think there's a growing movement in this country to realize that military-grade weapons should be reserved for the military and for law enforcement. And it just needs to stop. We need to get these weapons off the street.
I think we need to make our schools safe. But I think, to jump to assumptions is just premature. And I don't think that it really helps the dialogue and helps long-term to find solutions to this.
But this has been obviously going on for decades. There's not.
It has.
When
it
will,
has.
When will for, it not be premature? My God, it's been going on for decades, this problem.
Rob, I'm not saying that looking at the problem and looking for ways to solve it is premature. I think it's premature for those of us sitting around this table to make these kind of assumptions of this is going to work and this isn't going to work. I think we're I don't think we're there yet.
But I think it's our patriotic duty, actually.
But to be fair, I feel like I'm hearing out of you, people don't make movies shouldn't weigh in on whether or not that was
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. And I have a lot of opinions as to what it would be, but this is a serious discussion of what needs to be done. And I think I think it would be irresponsible of us to say, well, if you just ban these certain kind of weapons, it's going to solve the problem. I don't think we know that. I mean, I think those are absolutely things that we need to look at, we need to consider. Absolutely. Will arming teachers in schools be a solution? I don't think that's necessarily a good idea, but these are the kind of things that are being discussed, and I think that it's important. Mental health is another part of this that certainly needs to be looked at. Where was the FBI? Where were the law enforcement officers with this crazy person in Florida?
I would note that I think a lot of the mental health stuff has been, I would use the word debunked. I think it's been debunked based on what has been studied in other countries. I'm going to pivot here and ask you a question. We have a lot of data about guns and about firearms and about violence from other countries because we don't study it in this country because the CDC has effectively been told, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the CDC does not study gun violence because they have been threatened with the loss of funding. So, a very basic question. Should the CDC be able to study gun violence in this country?
I think everything should be on the table. Everything should be studied. This is a serious problem, and everything needs to be considered, whether it's mental health services, whether it's, you know, more reporting by individuals, whether it's the FBI being held accountable, other law enforcement officers. Absolutely.
We had the, this is obviously something the NRA has demanded, and they've gotten. It's been inserted in the federal budget for years. I was talking with Congressman David Price the other day, and he said he's going to try again. President Trump has actually put this in his budget this year, that the CDC cannot study gun violence. And it's absurd and obscene. And Congressman Price has said he's going to try again to get that provision out so that the CDC can study it. But it's just typical of how the NRA has the federal government and really North Carolina legislature wrapped around its finger. And until we break that stranglehold, we're not going to make any progress.
Well, this is a decades-old problem that has tentacles all the way through all levels of government, all levels of society. And, this isn't something that has occurred overnight. It's certainly something that isn't going to be solved overnight, but it's a serious issue. And I really commend, again, Speaker Moore for setting up this committee, for looking at it, for taking it seriously, very seriously.
Meanwhile, Republican lawmakers appear to be flirting with a subpoena. They offered a brief glimpse at their hand this week, I suppose, hinting that someone from Governor Roy Cooper's staff could be compelled to answer questions about this mitigation fund related to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Crystal ball time. Any reason to think that we're not heading down this path of a possible subpoena?
I think they'll figure this out, actually.
Really? An optimist?
I actually think we've had these, the Cooper's office and the legislature have obviously faced off over a lot of stuff, and they're both skilled political folks who play hardball with each other. I don't think it's going to go down to that level. I think we'll get the information that people need to know. I think what they'll probably find is that Governor Cooper cut a deal. Frankly, a lot of progressives think could have been a better deal, but it's certainly a darn sight better than Republicans would have cut. And the notion of people who have slashed education and repeatedly violating the Constitution, presuming to lecture Governor Cooper on funding education and with the mitigation fund and somehow violating the Constitution is just sort of funny, I think.
I think we're going to have to get answers to this. There's some fundamental questions with this $58 million deal that Governor Cooper worked out with the operators of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and then appropriating that money on his own. That is not a constitutional duty or authority that the governor has. That has to be answered. Now, the General Assembly came back and they appropriated the money as they are authorized to do, and it's their job to do that under our state constitution. So there's questions there. First of all,
indeed are questions. I think we're putting the cart a little bit ahead of the course, ahead of the horse. There's no money that's been appropriated yet. There is no money.
Right.
Yet.
Right.
There's an agreement, but there's no fund. There's
right.
no.
There's the memorandum of understanding that Roy Cooper worked out, and in the memorandum of understanding, it says he would appropriate the money. So there's the constitutional question, first of all, and I'm not sure that you can just reset it by saying, well, there isn't any money. Now, the General Assembly has stepped in, and in my mind, appropriately taken the role that they have to appropriate that money. But there's a lot of other questions that are out there. This deal is different than the deal that was made in Virginia for mm-hmm. a mitigation fund. Mm-hmm. This is very open-ended, and it includes, and the deal that Roy Cooper made is for three things. It was for economic development, it was for renewable energy, and it was for mitigation of the environmental things. But there's no designation of what that money goes for, what that $58 million goes for. A question that the General Assembly has, and I think they're going to continue to ask these questions, is how was that deal put together? Why is renewable energy part of this at all? And what were other things that were happening at the same time? All of this would go away if Roy Cooper would just answer the questions that the General Assembly has sent over.
I'm sure they'll figure it out. The question that might be asked of the General Assembly is, what's the deal you guys would have got? Here's a group of people who said, well, wait a minute, you've gone on for a long, let me talk to, okay? The General Assembly has forecast from the very beginning. They thought this was the greatest idea since sliced bread. They were willing to. I think it's quite likely that the General Assembly would have actually given money to the pipeline developers to build this pipeline. So Governor Cooper comes in. He cuts a deal to get $58 million to go to good causes. I think a lot of progressives have doubts about whether that was it should have been more money, could have been better use of that money. But the notion that the General Assembly is going to come in and presume to tell us that they could have done this better is preposterous. This wouldn't even exist.
I think it is a totally valid question. Hey, were you working on a fund? Did you think about these negotiations? I have not heard from anybody
at
the General Assembly. We would have done a better job. I don't even know if this was on their radar.
I don't think so. I doubt it. I don't think there's even a chance of that. And I think what's happened here is, once again, Governor Cooper has managed to sort of steer this middle course and he's beaten the General Assembly so many times on so many issues and made them look bad that they can't stand the idea he was going to get a victory here. So they're trying to manufacture a way to make it seem nefarious, when all it was just a voluntary agreement with these pipeline developers to put this cash up. And he's already made clear that it had nothing to do with the environmental decision that was issued. If any of that were to come, you know, I'm sure all the records and all the discussions will come into light. I hope that they do, and we'll figure this all out. But I can't imagine that this is really going to amount to anything in the long run.
Great, and I hope Rob's right. I hope it doesn't amount to anything. But Roy Cooper needs to answer the question so that we can determine that.
And I'm sure he will.
A final topic. North Carolina icon Billy Graham died this week. America's pastor was 99, one of the world's most influential preachers. Graham was a paradoxical figure. He once bailed Martin Luther King Jr. out of prison and was also recorded making anti-Semitic remarks to President Richard Nixon. What will you remember most about him?
I think I'll just remember the integrity and, you know, the long legacy that he has, not only in North Carolina, but the country and the world. And I can't say nearly as well as so many others have said the tributes to Billy Graham. But I think he's a North Carolinian that we can be proud of.
I think a lot of progressives who may not have even agreed with Reverend Graham when it came to his religion and to his particular brand of beliefs still had great respect for him and admired his, for the most part, his integrity. You mentioned a couple of slips that he had down through the years. But the thing that really set him apart from the modern day conservative mega preachers like his son, unfortunately, and Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and all those folks, was that he didn't purport to come out and tell people how to vote. He didn't inject himself into politics in such a blatant, direct, and I would say destructive way as so many on the far religious right have in recent years. So I think that's why, even though many people, progressives, would probably not resonate with his particular brand of religion, still had respect for the man and thought, you know, they appreciated his sincerity and commitment to his beliefs.
As someone in his mid-30s, I will own that I don't have a great appreciation for Billy Graham. I just won't. I've done some reporting on him, and I certainly will always wonder, and hearing from historians and biographers, about the shift that's happened with the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and Samaritan's Purse. Was it Billy's doing? Was it son Franklin's doing? And the smart people have said, we'll probably never know why that shift happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting to me as we think about just this very shift. I mean, would there be a place, is there a place in the world today for a figure like Billy Graham in this hyper-partisan time that we're in? And I tend to think, no, there isn't. I mean, he wouldn't exist today. One final follow-up, hopefully a bit of a fun one, but this came up this week in the newsroom and it came up with others. I referenced Billy Graham as one of, if not the most influential North Carolinian ever. We've had presidents, Polk and Jackson. We've had basketball folks, Michael Jordan and Dean Smith. We've had Frank Porter Graham. So many. The list goes on and on. I'm a jazz person. We've got Coltrane and Monk and Max Roach.
Don't forget Richard Petty.
King. A couple of names from each of you that just immediately come to mind. The most influential North Carolinian is – you can't pick a future one because that's no crystal ball here, but –
the reason Frank Porter Graham stands out so much to me is because North Carolina has for a long time stood out from the rest of the old Confederacy as a more progressive, a bastion of progressive thinking, forward thinking, anti-segregation, anti-racist, And I think Graham did a lot along those lines. That's one of the people that stands out for me.
Jeff, I agree with you. I think that Billy Graham is probably the most influential. Just the lives that he touched, the people that he... And you know, we're hearing that. We're hearing those stories of, you know, everyday people who saw him, heard him. Their mother took them to one of the meetings where Billy Graham was. You know, we're hearing that. I think that... And across the country, presidents, but also in other countries as well. So I think that reach was just phenomenal. But another one that I'll mention that comes to my mind is Bill Friday and the university system that he put together and that legacy that we still continue to enjoy today.
And maybe Andy Griffith, who was, of course, this iconic entertainer and an incredibly warm and caring human being who was devoted to progress in our planet.
And my only final note on that, and I did not know this. I learned this week somewhere in social media. Hopefully neither of you rolls your eyes at me. Andy Griffith in the show didn't carry a gun. I didn't know that.
It was just Barney, right?
And he carried his bullet in his back pocket?
He was the subject of a film to be made about him within the TV show called The Sheriff Without a Gun.
These conversations are recorded at the WUNC studios in the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. Remember, you can subscribe to the Politics Podcast at iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you capture those on-demand recordings. If there is a guest or a topic that you want to hear featured on the pod, let us know via email or social media. I'm at JTibbs, that's J_TIBS. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Have a good weekend. And your life doesn't change by the man that's elected. If you're loved by someone you're never rejected, decide what to be and go be it. There